This episode, I am joined once again by Steve Dowden to discuss his book, Modernism and Mimesis. I'd like to say a big thank you to my paying patrons and subscribers for making all of this work possible. And if you'd like to support the podcast going into 2024, please find links in the description below. Otherwise, I hope you all have a great new year. Enjoy. Steve Dowden, thanks once again for joining us on Hermetics Podcast. This episode, we're going to be discussing your 2020 book, Modernism and Mimesis, which is published by Palgrave Macmillan. This is a book that if I was to hastily describe it in a single sentence, like a single sentence thesis, that there is much, much more going on, especially with mimesis. If we're just to focus on that modernism aspect for the time being, in a single sentence, the thesis of this book, which is really pushing against a lot of the typical approaches to modernism in literature, in art, and as a movement as a whole, is modernism is not this overly complex sort of upper middle class thing to try really challenge and be elitist and be overly complicated and be obscurantist. Modernism, your argument is actually modernism is doing almost the inverse of that, and it's allowing people entry into a very simple way of writing, of creating. It's about the simplicity of experience. Is that, am I somewhat on the right lines there?
Yeah, that's right. That's what I'm up to. Mm-hmm. You've got, we'll sharpen that. You know, there are complexities to that, but yes, that's the main idea. And that seems to be what the people who have read the book have been most drawn to, the idea that modernism is not necessarily about sort of an elitist intellectualism, but it's about simplicity. You know, look at the artworks of Matisse. They're super simple. So why shouldn't we have begun with the idea of simplicity? Why did we automatically start with the idea of complexity in modernism? I think there's a historical answer to that question, but it skewed our understanding of modernism from the very outset of the idea of modernist artwork.
So I guess the question to ask in terms of the genesis of this book is, was there a point where you were reading, reading maybe a modernist text or looking at some modernist art, and you thought, no, I need to write about the idea that other thesis is kind of ridiculous? I mean, is that where it sprung from? I'm jumping back to our previous discussion on Bernhard. Did it spring from a sort of outrage at that idea?
No, well, the outrage grew slowly. This is a book with a long genesis. It began in the late 1970s when I started graduate school. So at that time, I began to become a regular reader of the New York Review of Books. And every time I picked the thing up, somebody would be talking about modernism. You know, here I was a student of German literature. And in German literature, I never heard of modernism. There was, and really still isn't, any such word. So I wondered, well, what is modernism? So I began to look into it. And the more I looked, the more I realized nobody really knew what it was. It was something people talked about as if they knew. And what they were really talking about was only a certain small set of writers, you know, Pound, Eliot, James Joyce, especially, and just a handful of others. So there was no real concept of modernism, certainly no definition of it, and probably there should not be a definition of it. So I began to write a dissertation about modernism in German literature. It was my first book. It was called Sympathy for the Abyss. And that's a quote from Thomas Mann from Death in Venice. You know, that was, Death in Venice was and is a key work of modernism. Well, sort of, not really. I backed off of that too, but I wasn't very happy with the book. And so I got interested in other things, but I kept thinking about modernism over the years. And then eventually I came back to it with the idea that if we're going to talk about modernism, we should look not only at literature, not only at English language literature, but at European literature in general, but also music and architecture and dance and poetry and painting and sculpture, all these things, to see if they had anything in common. So that's what I was trying to do in this book, to seek out what common ideas or features or characteristics might be there to discuss.
So, I mean, you mentioned Joyce there with a smirk, which is sort of apt. In a way, it almost seems like when people think modernism, especially in literature, of course, they think Ulysses. I mean, Ulysses as this absolute touchstone. I mean, it's almost like the equivalent of Duchamp's fountain in art, right? It's like everything now, or Kant's Critique of Pure Reason. It's like you talk about something, you go, well, we have to tie it back to Ulysses, right? Literature now, we have to always come back to Ulysses. And do you think, in a way, I mean, one, I guess the question is, from Ulysses, is that, does Ulysses as a text, would you say that exemplifies that normal reading of modernism? That's what most people consider that's like the pinnacle of modernist literature is Ulysses. And because of all that complexity, that's what we've come to understand modernism as.
Yes. So Ulysses is the epicenter of the conventional definition of modernism. And, you know, I think it came into being, you know, partly for unsavory reasons, because literature professors are always asking themselves, you know, well, what am I here for? What am I supposed to do? Then along comes people writing really difficult works of art like Joyce and Eliot and so forth. And they say, well, you know, here I can become a mediator of these very difficult texts to students and to the rest of the world. And so that gives them something to do. But that skews, you know, our understanding of early 20th century art and, you know, modernism in general, which I think, you know, continues into now. So the question, sort of the central question of my book, or at least the question with which I began, is if you look at Joyce's Ulysses, which everybody seems to agree is a modernist work, and you look at Kafka's Castle, which everybody seems to be is a modernist work, how can two books that are so absolutely opposed to one another both be modernist works? And the answer, I think, is they can't be. So I decided, how shall I think about this? What's the key to understanding the nature of this distinction, and what might this distinction have to do with modernism? And what it seems to me to be is that they have a different understanding of language and the right way it relates to the world. James Joyce is very optimistic about the power of language to capture the reality of everything and name it. Kafka's very pessimistic about the power of language to name everything. He thinks language can name a lot, but it can't name everything. So here I should back up again and explain another underlying thought here. Early in my career, even as an undergraduate, I read Eric Auerbach's great book, Mimesis. The subtitle is The Representation of Reality in Western Literature. It is a wonderful, wonderful book. And it's been important for all of literary criticism, but certainly for my own understanding of what it is I thought I was up to from the very outset. And in Mimesis, Auerbach begins with a chapter called Odysseus's Scar, in which he pits Homeric representation, you know, Homeric narrative against biblical narrative to show how different they are. And the difference is that Homeric narrative, the representation of reality, really believes in the power of language to name everything. It's another language optimistic work, whereas biblical narrative, and here Auerbach seems to be following Kierkegaard in the understanding of the binding of Isaac. The Bible, he says, biblical narrative leaves things out. It omits things. It's fraught with background. It never tells you everything. In the case of the binding of Isaac, you know, when the angel comes and frees Abraham of this responsibility of sacrificing his son, what does Abraham say? Nothing. He says nothing at all. And, you know, the reader of the Bible, the interpreter, is thrown back on his or her own resources to figure out what this silence means. So there are two concepts of mimesis at work here. One is where language has the power to say everything, and the other is that it's more expression than representation. But I think that that's also mimesis, right? It's expressing things by leaving things out. So Auerbach basically drops this biblical complementary tradition of mimesis and only follows the Greek positive version, which leads, you know, straight to James Joyce, which is what it's basically a parody of the Odyssey. So I see Kafka as belonging to this other tradition of mimesis, which leaves things out. You know, one of my favorite lines in all of Kafka comes from his very last story, Josephine the Singer, or the Mouse People, in which the narrator of that story, you know, it's all about Josephine, who's the singer, and it's fifing, it's whistling or squeaking, or it's what they do. And they can't figure out what makes her squeaking different from anybody else's. And there's this one query where the narrator says, is it her voice? Is it her singing that so enchants us? Or is it not rather the solemn stillness that enfolds her frail little voice? You know, this solemn stillness, this quietness is, I think, you know, a modern version of Abraham's silence. So this is where I'm coming from in this juxtaposition of Joyce and Kafka, two traditions of mimesis complementary.
But that doesn't make them modernist. Still doesn't make them, in a way, modernist. I mean, it's the two sides to, I mean, it's the two sides to the approach to language, which are both kind of strangely biblical in a way. I mean, one's almost Edenic in the sense of you have the original language of you name the things like Adam did, and then the other one is almost like the fall, just as an aside. But, you know, from that, how does your thesis evolve, I guess, is the question there. I mean, still it's difficult to find this it's almost as if at this point modernism is still that label which is used to sort of justify a certain, oh, you can't approach that text until you've sort of come through me.
So here's the deal. So the conventional idea about modernism is it's a turning away from the tradition of the 19th century. So if you read Middlemarch, say, and then you read Ulysses, you know, it seems like there's a big difference, and there is. But if you look at it from the perspective of mimesis, they're both all about the power of language to name things positively. And Joyce is so optimistic about the power of language to name things positively that even the inner life, you know, you can turn that into language. Everything, you know, the whole technique of the book is this interior monologue. So it's subjectivity. It's instead of language imitating the outside world, it's language imitating the inside world. And Kafka doesn't go for that. You know, Kafka even says in his notebooks, you know, there's no way to describe the inner world the way you describe the outer world. So the only way to get at the inner world is by certain kinds of strategic silences and ellipses and figurative language. You know, you can never say to that's, and that's the whole strategy of the castle. So whatever it is that the castle is or conceals can never be named. Whereas James Joyce can name everything. There's no secrets in Joyce. Everything gets told.
But then there's an irony there, I think, for Joyce. And I mean, I think he tries to wrap this up in Finnegan's Wake with its recursive structure, in the sense that a book eventually does have to end. Eventually you have to stop naming things, so something's always left out. But it does make me think that maybe Finnegan's Wake, I mean, I don't know where that's really defined as a genre, but maybe that's a strange midpoint here of the whole thing. You know, people sort of often heralded as basically the most difficult book you can read. But I think that's buying in once again to the, you know, the thesis on modernism that you're trying to push against. But actually, you know, there's a Finnegan's Wake, a secondary book called a Symposium, where really the point the author in that makes is just to trust Joyce, just to go with this experience and this flow of the words. And when you hear Joyce read it aloud in one of the few recordings, you realize that this is just this sort of experiential prose that it doesn't need to be as complicated as people are making it. I'm not sure where I was going with that, but Joyce, I think, wraps up the irony of having to at some point finish the book. At some point it is this defined thing that has to leave something out. Or do you not think that's the case with Ulysses?
Well, in that selection of essays that you're talking about, Beckett has an essay in which he says about Work in Progress, which was what Finnegan's Wake was called before it was Finnegan's Wake. He says, this book is not about something. This book is something. Now, I think that's a totally modernist attitude. I think also Beckett was probably talking more about himself and his own aspirations than he was about Joyce, but he's still probably right about Finnegan's Wake. So that's why I concentrate more on Ulysses. Finnegan's Wake gets mentioned in passing, but I don't really understand exactly what to do with it. Maybe I'll develop this further, but Finnegan's Wake is sort of a problem.
But it does, I mean, you were mentioning there, I mean, this is this other key element of modernism in the sense that the prefix is modern, you know, and which inherently is this sort of self-aggrandizing and self-congratulatory term, right? Of like, we are the moderns, we are the new, we, in a way, we are the best is often the conflation. But it, you know, you were mentioning about the idea of this split, like, okay, we're now in the modern era, we move from Middlemarch. But then if you think about a book like Lawrence Stern's Tristram Shandy, which is just slap bang in the middle of all this, is a strange, you know, a strange text which breaks everything up. Do you think these, in a way, the genres aren't really all that helpful? Because once you, as you have done, begin to look at, say, Kafka and Joyce, you could say, well, what use is this now if you're lumping all of these together? And also when 200 years down the line, 200 years previous, we had Tristram Shandy, which is breaking things apart.
So Tristram Shandy, I would say, belongs to this other tradition of mimesis, right? Mm-hmm. That points toward Kafka, not toward Ulysses. Mm-hmm. So my argument is that basically, and this really isn't my argument, it's T.S. Eliot's argument, is that Ulysses is the grand culmination of Victorian fiction. Mm-hmm. And I think that makes perfect sense. He said that to, I can't remember where he said that. It turns up in Virginia Woolf's diaries. I think it was at a party. But maybe he wrote it in an essay, too. I'm not sure. But in any case, he said it. And I think it's right, because James Joyce has more in common with Middlemarch than he does with Kafka. So he's the very end of the 19th century tradition. And so if there's a turning that takes place, it takes place with Kafka and with Beckett.
So stereotypical modernism isn't modern.
That's right. That's right.
Do you think there's a, you know, what is the relationship between modernism and modernity?
So modernity, what is modernity? We've got the ancient world, the medieval world, and the modern world. So when and where and how does the modern world begin? The conventional answer, which I accept, is that it begins probably with a discourse on method. It begins with Descartes. And Cartesian doubt, and what does he doubt? He doubts that everything exists until he gets to the point where he can't doubt anymore that he's doubting. Mm-hmm. And so the ego, the subject, becomes the foundation of the world. Mm-hmm. And the world is suddenly, the world is nature, mind and nature is divided for good. So modernity is all about subjectivity. This is, you know, this is Heidegger's point in his essay, The Age of the World Picture. And that was certainly decisive for my own thinking. So I think that modernism is all about overcoming the subjectivity of modernity. Mm. And James Joyce, you know, is all about subjectivity. Kafka is not. Kafka's about the impossibility of subjectivity, as is Beckett, right? Mm-hmm. All we have is language, for better or for worse. You know, and there are other figures. Look at Heinrich von Kleist, for example, whom Kafka admired greatly. So it's a sad and funny story. He lived in the Enlightenment. He was born in 1777. And he was an Enlightenment man. He thought all you have to do is believe in reason, make a plan for your life. He wrote an essay about this. You know, you have to make a plan for your life. You stick to that plan. You know, you think scientifically and reasonably, and life will fall into place. And then in about 1790 or so, he read the Critique Pure Reason. And he discovered that Kant was saying, well, yes, you know, there's very much you can do with reason, but reason has its limits. And this did not worry Kant or his father. There was one little bit, but it crushed Kleist, because after, you know, after you reach the limit of reason, then you find a thing in itself about which we can ultimately know nothing. Mm-hmm. And Kleist found this, he was an odd guy. He found this deeply disturbing, because it meant that he couldn't really know anything. He said, you know, it's like wearing green glasses. The whole world looks green and you can never know what it really looks like. Mm-hmm. And this transformed him into a writer. And he began to write plays and stories about all kinds of contingencies in life that you can't account for. And that, you know, the subject's reliance on reason is an illusion. So you can see why this appealed to Kafka so much. The only tool we have for grasping the world is language, and it's unreliable, but still it's all we've got. So that's what made him a writer. And that's what he was doing as a writer, trying to understand how much and what he could really take of reality for himself and deal with.
So the irony here then is that all we've got is language. But yes, in the sense that Joyce is using it, we are harking back to almost, you know, the Enlightenment mindset of, you know, we just use language to describe absolutely the most intricate details, 1,000-page novel, et cetera, of a 24-hour period, et cetera, et cetera. And then, of course, the irony then moving through to someone like Kafka, and as you've said, is the importance, in a way, is to a degree language, but it's to the extent that language leaves something out, which we then see exacerbated in the likes of Beckett, maybe people like Chiron, maybe. But, you know, as it gets more and more and more minimal, to the extent of just leaving more and more things out. So this void that we have against language is now our means of communication. What's communicated is in the gap. The one thing that, you know, really interests me here is the way that you describe Kafka in the sense of what is left out, is it in a way a very, and the way that you describe this, all that's left is the subject, is once again stereotypically, you know, we've had the stereotype of modernism, it's stereotypically postmodern. Right, there's no overarching narratives left. There's no objectivity left. All we've got left is this sort of relativist position, and it makes me wonder whether or not modernism is postmodernism, and they're just completely intertwined. And you can leave Joyce in that sort of hangover of Victorian literature, but as we move through to modernism with Kafka, etc., you are just entering fully into this free-floating world.
Well, my view is that postmodernism is just an academic boondoggle. It never happened. You know, it's just certain features of modernism that were then rephrased and recycled as something else. But there was no post about it. It was just a failure of certain writers to look at the big picture of modernism and not. You know, I think we're still in the modernist period, the late modernist period. You know, you read somebody like Fleur Yeghi, a writer I admire immensely. She's totally a modernist. Mm. Totally. You know, coming straight out of Robert Walser. Walser and Kafka are closely affiliated. So, yeah. So I think you're right. Postmodernism never happened, and it's just kind of an embarrassment now to talk about it.
As we move away from that complexity, though, into the likes of Kafka, what is, you know, the modernism that you're articulating and defending? What are these modernists trying to do with this simplicity?
Well, they're trying to overcome the myth of the power of the subject. You know, that you know, we can never know the world entirely, and we'd best get used to it. But it's not such a bad situation, because art itself is exhilarating. You know, why did Kafka write? He wrote because he found it exhilarating. Because he could latch on to little pieces of reality that seem persuasively real, certain kinds of experiences, and, you know, other people can read these experiences and also, you know, feel, you know, Heidegger always wants people to feel at home in the world. I don't think Kafka ever wanted people to feel at home in the world. He wanted them to feel the way they really felt, whether it was at home or not at home. He just wanted to get things right. He wanted to get it right. And you can't get it right by subscribing to a philosophical system You know, so these modernists have a lot in common with anti-systematic philosophers like Nietzsche. You know, Nietzsche also wanted to knock the bottom out of subjectivity. That's what the Dionysian is. You know, that's a closer, more authentic relationship to the real, rather than believing in the absolute power of the individual subject and the absolute power of reason and the myth of progress. You know, are people, simple question, are people happier now than they were 2,000 years ago? Probably not.
No one's ever been happy. I refuse to believe it. It's interesting.
Okay, but the question is, are we more unhappy now than we were 2,000? Well, maybe, you know, maybe.
Well, we spend a lot of time redefining it into something very, very easy to achieve, and no one wants to admit that, you know, it's very easy to achieve happiness, but that doesn't necessarily state whether or not it's fulfilling, right? I mean, I'm not huge on Zizek, but I'm very much with him on the idea of stuff happiness, because the happiness that we've got is really boring, and I have no interest in going on a cruise ship or whatever it might be.
More like comfort and convenience and entertainment. Yeah, that's not happiness.
No, what's happiness?
Not having to think about those things. So if people 2,000 years ago were more happy than we are, you know, in a world where, you know, disease was a kind of problem that it isn't now, or maybe, you know, maybe it is, but they had less recourse than we had. I don't think they were unhappier, and they might have been happier because they weren't quite so self-conscious, not so self-absorbed. You know, this is Hegel's thesis of the unhappy consciousness. When you begin to think too much about yourself, then you really can't be happy. If you just sort of live in the world, neither subjectively nor objectively, if you just carry on your life without thinking about yourself too much, you're likely to feel more fulfilled.
So I'm gonna throw something rather abstract at you and see what you make of it. I mean, I spoke earlier about Auerbach's two forms of mimesis there, in the terms of, you know, naming everything, which I sort of said it reminds me of Adamic, Garden of Eden, the above. Adam had the power to name everything exactly, and the name was one-to-one. It's sort of like the phenomenological, I don't know, I pure idealism. Like, that is what I've just named it. And then we have the Fall, and we have the Tower of Babel, and all of a sudden all language gets muddled up, and we can't articulate anything. And this seems to relate, these two forms seem to relate to, you know, this notion of what Joyce is doing is very much the Victorian Enlightenment sensibility of the above, of something logocentric, of like abiding by this higher reason to name everything, which is like the vertical, right? Like you know, some higher cause which allows us to say have an objectivity and an authority. And it seems the way you articulate modernism is a sort of a complete dissipation to the horizontal, falling into, you know, you mentioned Heidegger being in the world, like this inherent familiarity. We don't need the higher anymore. We don't need the above, the beyond. Fall into and just dissipate into experience itself. Kind of like with Finnegan's Wake, there is experience. And you don't second guess it, because when you start second guessing it, you abide by, you know, something else, be it even a lecturer. He says, no, you can't understand that until you've come through, you know, come through me. What do you make of that?
Well, let me pull out the piece of Finnegan's Wake that speaks most directly to me. It's the scene where the two washerwomen are in the Liffey, just chatting away, having a great time as they do the laundry. And gradually, one turns into a stone and one turns into a tree, and all that's left is the chatter of the river. I just love that. You know, that's a return to unself-consciousness. You know, they're just doing what they do, and they're happy in it. They're neither happy nor not happy. It's just what they do. They're totally in it. You know, whereas the modern condition is to worry about, well, you know, where am I going to get the money to pay the rent? Will I get a new car next year? Will my children go to the best possible school? Will they get good jobs? No, you're constantly thinking about yourself. But, you know, in Joyce's vision of these two women, they're just totally absorbed in what they do. And the joy of their chatter, which I think is kind of like literature, right? Mm. It's a form of chatter that it engages us. We like to hear it. It's very somatic. It's sensuous. It's like the chatter of a river. You know, we're taught, you know, always to think very cerebrally about literature. And certainly the modernism of T.S. Eliot and Joyce and Pound invites us to be cerebral. But I think literature is, first of all, somatic. Think of what Nietzsche says about the birth of tragedy, right? It comes out of music and dance. It's not the story, not the intellectual part that comes first, but the somatic part. And of course, that's exactly what we've lost. We don't have those parts anymore. All we have is the intellectual words. But in Joyce, especially in Finnegan's Wake, you know, words revert to the somatic, words revert to music.
This seems to be then why you have quite an emphasis on nature and animals in your book. They appear time and time again.
That's right. I'm trying to break down this division between mind and nature, this Cartesian division between self and world. Mm. And I think that's what modernism is all about. I see this also in Susan Sontag. You know, I think she's a wonderful, wonderful literary critic. And in this famous essay that's always made a big impression on me. And in a way, this book comes directly out of the last line of her essay against interpretation. She says, what we need is not a hermeneutics of literature, but an erotics. An erotic meaning, you know, that literature is first of all something that's sensuous and not cerebral. I think she's mistaken when she says hermeneutics, because hermeneutics just means, you know, interpretation. It doesn't mean anything in particular. She too has a hermeneutics, but she doesn't have method. You know, she's opposed to method. She's also anti-systematic in her criticism. I think that's what makes it so strong, because it's very musical. It's very oriented toward what you hear, and only secondarily then intellectual. So when she says we need an erotics of literature, I'm trying to show how modernism answers that call for an erotics, not meaning sexual, but just sensuous in the widest sense. Mm.
But I mean, to reference something I wrote, there's a great irony. I don't know if you'd agree with this. Something I wrote actually when I was doing my undergrad in fine art, it was my dissertation. And there's a great irony that almost every academic I know, you know, their undergrad is a thesis, the master's is the antithesis, and then when they go on doing PhD, they go back to the first thing. And it's sort of, you always get haunted by that first thing you write. And my dissertation was on the problem of irony in the modern world. And the basic point in a nutshell was, if an artist was today to paint, let's say, a landscape painting like John Constable, you know, just a very sincere landscape painting, it would, by these people who are, you know, the elite, the stereotypical modernists, they would immediately put that blockade up and say, "Ah, I see what you're doing there. You know, it's ironic." And it was about this paradox of how can we actually be sincere now, because we always are just like, we have this second guessing, we have this almost parasite of the hermeneutic, the ideas. And it's almost like we've entered into a time where, you know, a painting can't just be a painting. A sentence, a description of lilies can't just be a description of lilies. You know, there is always this other thing, and an inability, something is always in the way of us just having the experience.
Yeah, that's this self-consciousness I was talking about. That is self-consciousness. You know, you just can't be direct. For my version of exactly the same problem is, you know, as when I was young and adolescent, I was a great reader. I just loved reading. And then I got to college and found out I'd been doing it all wrong, right? I wasn't nearly intellectual. I didn't have a theory, right? I didn't have a method of criticism. So I spent a lot of time over the next few years learning about all the methods and all the theories possible. You know, I went from living and going to school in West Texas to Berkeley. And when I got to Berkeley, all anybody was talking about was Derrida and Derrida or Marx. Those were sort of the two poles. So you had to sign on one or the other. And, you know, it took me a long time to unlearn that. Maybe the decisive moment was once when I went to a very large Rothko exhibition. So Rothko, there's a painter with no cerebral content at all. It's purely sensuous. And I thought, I felt the power. I felt the mana. I thought, this is just great. And it led me to wonder, you know, what's the relationship between a Rothko and a painting that is figurative, a really great painting that is figurative? And I think that the answer is that that the figurative, what makes a figurative painting work, is really the same thing that makes a Rothko work. It's the sensuous interplay of the colors and the forms, you know. And there's a theme too, but it's really the sensuous part that comes first. So this is, you know, this is the same thing as Nietzsche's thought. It's the dance and the music that comes first, and the cerebrality is then added on afterwards. And then if you fetishize the cerebrality, it gets, it overtakes everything else, and then you become obsessed with theories of interpretation and so forth. And, you know, you've sort of talked yourself into a kind of self-consciousness that you can't overcome. Does that make sense?
It does make sense. I mean, I was thinking while you were speaking about this sense of not getting caught up in the theories and the cerebral nature of things, in the sense of, in terms of art history, you know, the moment when metaphorically speaking, the walls of the USSR come down, and we sort of go, okay, well, let's see what, you know, art has been produced here, and what are we presented with is Kazimir Melyevich's Black Square, you know, the cosmic black void, right? You know, and it's almost like, okay, well, what's been going on over here is, I don't know, whatever, I guess, abstract expressionism to a degree, the American masculinism, this vital thing, and then you open the floodgates over here, and it's not cerebral. You know, both of those aren't cerebral, but you understand instinctively, intuitively, what's been going on in the USSR for this sort of the creative passion of artists is, okay, there's this sort of horrible, which is now, I mean, it's even more beautiful now because all the paint's flaking. It's sort of this horrible, rotting black void. But, you know, and people just love to put up barriers. I mean, I always used to, when I used to tell people back in the day, you know, I'm studying fine art, people would always go, sometimes I just don't get art. And I would just say, well, you don't need to.
That's right.
You don't need, and that ruins everything. You know, you go into an art gallery thinking, right, okay, I have to put my art glasses on. Like, well, and just look at the painting. Just look at the painting. Read the book. You know, it's a curse. It's a parasite. You know, it ruins everything, I think.
I absolutely agree. And I think that modernism was trying to undo that. A lot of modernism was. Mm. So this is, you know, there's no... Modernism is a moving target. You know, you can't really have a definition of it, but you can try to throw a net over it by asking certain questions and seeing what happens. So, you know, think of T.S. Eliot's Wasteland. Mm-hmm. It's a great poem. Mm-hmm. But I think what makes it great is not the really cerebral parts that we feel like we have to understand. It's because it sounds so great when you read it out loud. You know, it's powerful. It touches you. And that, you know, that being touched, that the somatic part is the most important part. The cerebral stuff you can do perfectly well without.
So why then include, you know, almost the most tricky and trickstery of artists in your book, Marcel Duchamp, especially his, you know, infamous and just almost timeless now painting piece, you know, Given, which I believe has another name, which is
Why? Given and the Illumination. That's in there because I went to the museum in Philadelphia and I saw it. It made me mad. So have you ever seen it?
I've only seen it online. I guess we should explain how it works.
So there's, all right, it's an installation and it's in a room by itself. And then you go in at one at a time, and there's a door, and the door has a little hole, a kind of a peephole. And then you look through the peephole to see this looks a little bit like a Renaissance park from a Da Vinci. And there's this nude woman. You see only her lower half, and she's splayed and has a sort of crooked vulva, and it's And what made me mad about it was that what he does, like you said, he's a trickster. He positions you, he positions the viewer as a voyeur. Mm. And I can see the point, and it's very cute, but I think that I think he's jerking us around. Mm. So he does not come off very well in my book.
What's the importance of that sort of being forced into that act? I mean, of that voyeurism. Do you think there's another layer to that he understands? Like, he's trying to make you see what you are normally doing? Like,
well, no, I think I would say that the trick is this. He's intentionally positioning you as a subject and the art as an object. Mm. And I think the force of the modernism that interests me most is overcoming that field. You know, you don't have to be a subject looking at an object. You can just be a person looking at a painting or experiencing a painting. I think the Rothkos are another good example of that. You know, they're close and they're big and the color's intense. It's not a subject-object situation. Mm. You know, you're not. I mean, you can try to be very intellectual about it. It's kind of hard not to, but the paintings are so good and so powerful that it becomes just a unitary experience rather than a subject-object situation. But Duchamp, in this late work, you know, he gave up art, you know, to become a chess player. Mm-hmm. Why a chess player? That's something, you know, that's also something that's sort of unitary. It's a game. It's something you do. It's something that you're absorbed in, and that's sort of the opposite of this particular work of art of his.
I think
it's a parody of the art world, a parody of the way the art world works, a parody of the way traditional art works.
Yeah, and I think that's why he might have moved. I mean, I think he really enjoyed chess, but I also remember just from his biography that he was very apathetic, very. To be honest, I think to a certain degree lazy. And I wonder if, you know, he's clearly a genius in terms of art. And I do wonder if his genius sort of almost leapt out of bounds too early on. You know, if you think about the things he was doing, you can almost, okay, say, you know, well before Warhol, he signed a piece of paper, yeah. Gave it to his dentist and said, you know, that'll do. And, you know, with the alter ego as well that he had, and of course the fountain and various other things, ready-mades that he did. And the great irony, of course, that none of the fountains now are actually, they're all replicas of the ready-made, which he probably foresaw. And I think maybe he was bored, you know, he saw the game and just thought, you know what, why bother? You know, you guys just keep playing the game. I think that's quite sad because he, you know, what we've been talking about is you get caught up in that game and you end up reading more and more books on theory. You keep trying to, I have to understand this instead of just reading it. And he got so caught up in it, he gave up. Instead of, it's almost like he was reluctant to just step back and say, why don't you just go paint something? You know, why don't you just go create something because you want to? Which seems, you know, I mean, so you mentioned, you know, this, the world is disenchanted. And there's just a couple of things I want to bring in. So, you know, we've had this subject object split, and it seems to me that this, you have this, the subject with Descartes is modernism, and then as that subjectivity sort of gets so extreme with the experiencing and you move back from theory at all, it doesn't move into objectivity, it moves into like just non-subjectivity. You're just there. Sounds a bit pretentious, but it's, you're experiencing, you're with it, you're just whatever. Is that enchantment, do you think? Is that what it is to be enchanted?
I think so. I think so. So, but you know, the way you stated enchantment might overstate it. It might be that enchantment is not the big deal that we've all made it out to be. You know, the enchanted world when you know the enchanted world was when people believed in witches, and we really don't want to go back to burning witches. You know, that's one side of enchantment. That's the dark side of enchantment, but. I think you've just described the sweet side when you're just a member, you're just in the world and you don't have to think about being in the world. You just do what you do.
Doesn't bode well for the future of academia, though.
I don't know. I mean, the future of academia, it certainly doesn't bode well for the future of academia as it is, but I don't think my little book is going to make a big splash in academia. I mean, it's going to roll off the academic back like water off a duck. I mean, in fact, this thing was published 3 years ago, and it only ever got one review. So academia will just ignore it. I think if this book has any life at all, it will be from people who are just now becoming graduate students and are getting tired of the bill of goods they're being sold. They might stumble across it and think, this might be a way of looking at things.
There is an interesting question there then. There's a, in terms of, you know, this parasitic sort of something invading and saying, right, you can't just approach it yourself though. You have to put something up, you have to bring in a theory, you have to understand it. Is there an alternative where we can still analyze, still engage, maybe would be the better word, but we don't take it apart?
Well, I think I could give you a couple of examples. We talked about one already, Susan Sontag. She's great at this. She's great at this. Another is William Gass, right, the essayist. He's also great at it. So, you know, I think there will always be people like that, but they're probably not going to be in the academy. I guess Gass was. He taught in a university. And Susan Sontag didn't.
I mean, that's something to mention, though. I mean, coincidentally, I'm reading The Tunnel at the moment, and I think there's a lot happening there in terms of what you're writing about in Gass is The Tunnel, in the sense of people like to think they've drawn out all of their subjectivity from their, you know, objective, well thought out theoretical work, you know. And for those who don't know, The Tunnel is a man who's written a book on the Nazis and the rise of Hitler and the atrocities of the Holocaust, which I can't remember. I think it's Guilt and Something in Hitler's Germany is the fictional title in the book. But the actual book, The Tunnel, is all his margin notes and his own thoughts, much like, I guess, maybe more Finnegan's Wake, flowing into this book, and you end up with this complete mess, which no one would ever want to sort of publish in the fiction of that book. Maybe that's Gass's little comment on academia, that none of these books are as pure as we'd like them to be.
Yeah, I never finished reading The Tunnel. I didn't love it, but I really like his essays, or his little book about translating Rilke. I thought that was wonderful.
What would you advise? There's a question. What would you advise? How are we to approach? I mean, you know, we end up in the bind of not wanting to, I guess, give rules or give advice. But, you know, what is it to approach a piece of art? What is it to approach a piece of literature? And how to do it without that, you know, destruction?
Well, I think most people probably do it right anyway. You know, you read a book and you like it or you don't, and then they don't think about it anymore. But if you want to continue thinking about it, so how do you do that? So if you're a graduate student right now in literature, all is lost because, you know, you're going to have to take a course called Literary Theory of History or History of Criticism. And, you know, you'll do Lacan 1 week and reader response theory the next, deconstruction the next, feminist theory. Then at the end of the course, your assignment's going to be, okay, take one of these theories and look at a work of art through it. So, you know, already the structure is just like given, right? You're forced to look at art through a peephole. And to bring Kleist back into it, you know, if you put on green glasses, the whole world looks green. That's the way literary theory works. And I'm not really against theory. I'm for theory, but I'm against doctrine, because the upshot is that, you know, you take some theoretical reflections and then you have to turn them into a doctrine that you apply to literature. But that always means that in the premises, the conclusions are already contained. So if you have a theoretical doctrine that you're applying, you know, you already know what you're going to find, which means that literature has been cut out of the equation effectively. What you really want from literature is to hear what it has to say, which is why my favorite theoretician is Hans-Georg Gadamer, because his book, Wahrheit und Methode, Truth and Method, is all about the limitations of method. It's about the power of art to speak the truth, but about the weakness of method when it comes to listening. So what he says, sort of unhelpfully, but I think truthfully, is you have to listen to what art is saying, and that's the beginning point, right? So if you read a novel, say, or you look at a picture, you be aware of what really appeals to you about it, and then try to think about that and write about that in a disciplined way, not a way that's determined by a doctrine or a theory, but a way that, you know, once again, Susan Sontag, I think, is the perfect example of how to do that. You know, she begins with an observation, and then she develops it critically and in a disciplined way, but not necessarily methodically. So all is not lost, unless you're a graduate student in literature.
Yeah. Is there anything you'd like to add about your book that we haven't touched upon?
Oh, nothing except that I had a great time writing it. I wanted to do a chapter on dance and a chapter on architecture, but I got tired of writing it. And I think I would have had to learn too much about dance to do it persuasively. So I left those chapters out. So I hope that there are people out there who hear the chapters I didn't write.
What are you working on now?
I'm working on two books right now. One is called Critique of Erotic Reason. And the idea of this book is that Eros is also something that you can't name, and that there's no way to get at it scientifically. And therefore, the only possible way to address it is through art. It's going to be about novels from Goethe and Austen to the present. And I got about 100 pages written of that. And the other book, which I haven't put pen to paper yet, is about Friedrich Hölderlin. It's going to be called Hölderlin and the Nature of Poetry. And I'm going to try to find a different way of situating Hölderlin vis-a-vis the 18th century and the present than the usual ones. He was very interested. He was an idealistic philosopher himself, but, you know, coming back to the question of the subject, he began to think beyond the subject-object dichotomy. Mm-hmm. And that's what I'm going to be writing about in Hölderlin, how he does that and how his poetry is not exactly what it's seemed to be so far because of our excessively intellectual approach to it. Mm.
Well, when they're both released, I'd love to discuss them with you.
All right.
But I'll be sure to put links for Modernism and Mimesis in the description below. But yeah, I think that's a good place to finish up. I think we've
I enjoyed talking to you once again.
Thanks very much.
Thank you.